AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a great show for you today. Our guest is going to be the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, here to talk about the state of civil liberties in the United States today on a range of issues, and we'll especially be taking aim at the war on terror and the erosion of American democracy. That's the subtitle of her new book, Taking Liberties, that we'll be talking about. It's going to be a great hour with Susan Herman. I hope you'll join us. But before we get to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Industry lobbyists are pushing for a Federal Communications Commission makeover, and the House Energy and Commerce Committee is ready to comply. This week, it passed the Federal Communications Commission Process Reform Act, a bill that, according to Free Press political advisor Joel Kelsey, will make the agency more accountable to the companies it's supposed to regulate than the consumers it's supposed to protect.
It creates a number of new bureaucratic hoops that the FCC would have to jump through before issuing a rulemaking proceeding or an industry-wide rule. The bills also give companies that would be unhappy with FCC decision-making many more tools to fight the FCC in court if they're unpleased with the way that the FCC has made a decision in a particular instance.
The bill passed the committee with nearly unanimous opposition from Democrats. Kelsey explains that the bill would give industry more power than consumers.
So there's a section in the bill that would prevent the FCC from adopting rules that, quote, impose an additional burden on industry, end quote, which could prevent the FCC from fulfilling its congressional mandate of protecting consumers and promoting the public interest, particularly when a significant public interest benefit would outweigh a minor industry burden.
Kelsey was also concerned with a provision that requires the FCC to prove that consumer harm exists before the agency could proceed with a rulemaking.
So instead of saying, we're looking at this market, it's developing in a way that could have bad implications for consumers, we would like to adopt a rule to prevent that from happening, this bill would require the FCC actually wait until consumers are getting harmed in the marketplace and then provide that harm as evidence for going forward with the rulemaking. And to us, that just seems like bad policy. It's kind of like waiting for the financial collapse before you pass rules to regulate the banks.
Public interest advocates oppose the bill, but believe that true reform still needs to be on the table.
I think there's pretty much unanimous thinking in the public interest community that at some point we need to address the revolving door nature of key staff positions and even commissioners at the Federal Communications Commission. Commissioners, commission staff just shouldn't be worrying about where they're going to go next in their career when they're making decisions about the industries they're supposed to be regulating.
As newspapers make their way through the tricky terrain of digital media, much of the conversation has begun to focus on the business side of the industry. The Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism produced a new study that details how newspapers are faring in trying to build digital revenue. Co-author Mark Jerkowitz.
This effort is directed at really seeing how successful and how quickly, if at all, the newspaper industry can move toward a model that will sustain the kind of journalism that has been sustained in the past.
The study looked at private financial data from 38 papers and in-depth interviews with senior executives who own a total of 330 dailies. Jerkowitz gives us the bad news first.
So far, the industry is not doing well in making this shift from a diminishing legacy model to a new digital model. The chasm is still there. The dollar chasm is still there. For every $1 that these companies were earning in digital revenue, they were losing $7 in print.
The data suggests that we will continue to see smaller newsrooms and less distribution of print products, like dailies moving to 3 days a week or even a single Sunday edition. And more newspapers may fold completely. The study lists several reasons why newspapers are having so much trouble adapting to this new world. And one of the biggest reasons for failure is the newsroom culture.
It's a considerable effort to teach and retool a sales staff that has been used to selling a print product, you know, and print advertising. You know, back in the good old days when we had 20% profit margins and sales meant basically picking up the phone and taking orders, teaching these folks to now start to sell digital products, to learn the language, to learn the jargon, to be able to start to introduce the conversation to local merchants who may not know much about it, is a serious, ongoing, and you know, daunting effort.
But the study contains some good news as well. Some papers are successfully offsetting print losses with digital gains, and others are trying new revenue streams, like retail digital malls or digital agencies that provide consulting services to area businesses.
Really, nobody has figured everything out yet. It does raise that question of, well, just how long can this journey be, and how much time is there to embark on this journey at a time when most newspapers are still hemorrhaging print dollars as heavily as they are?
You can find the study, The Search for a New Business Model, at journalism.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580. Our guest today, live on the phone with us from New York City, is Susan Herman. She's the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, since 2008, and a professor at Brooklyn Law School. She's also the author of a brand new book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy, just published by Oxford University Press. Professor Herman, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Bob. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, I think the ACLU is an organization that needs no introduction to any American. I think it's one of the best known groups in the country, certainly nonprofit groups in the country. Yet I was doing a little research for the show, and I learned quite a bit just sort of looking at a handful of websites about it. So rather than assume our listeners know a whole heck of a lot about the ACLU, could you just talk a little bit about its history, what it does, how many members it has, how it works?
Sure. The ACLU was founded in 1920, right after World War I, and the immediate impetus was the suppression of speech during World War I, that people were not allowed to say things that were unpopular. Also, right after World War I, there were the Palmer Raids, where Attorney General Mitchell Palmer rounded up thousands of people after there had been an incident. You know, a bomb exploded pretty close to where he was. So he rounded up thousands of people with no evidence that a lot of them had been involved, especially immigrants. He deported people, kept people in custody for a long time. So the ACLU was founded, really, we sort of regard our theme as defending people who are targets of discrimination or unfairness in some form or another. So we started out in free speech. Some of the highlights in the 90-plus years that we've been around, we worked on the Scopes trial, about the right of a teacher to teach evolution without being criminally prosecuted.
You might get that case come back to you again in the future, it looks like.
Exactly. One of the principal founders of the ACLU, Roger Baldwin, used to say that no battle for civil liberties ever stays won.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palmer Raids sound familiar with what's been happening recently. The First Amendment issues recur, racial injustice, all the kinds of things that we do, we just have to keep doing.
And then how many members does the ACLU have? How many chapters? I mean,
We have 50 affiliates. It's approximately one affiliate per state. We have a wonderful affiliate in Illinois. And we have over 500,000 members. We reached actually our peak of membership during the Bush years because so many Americans were alarmed by what was happening in the context of the war on terror, I think, that to me, I think they began to understand a lot of the things that the ACLU had been saying all along about the need for due process and the need for government accountability.
Now, our guest today, for those just tuning in, Susan Herman, president of the ACLU, author of the new book, Taking Liberties. As the president, I'm sure she's eager to answer any questions concerning the whole range of civil liberties issues that the ACLU works on and weighs in on, voting rights, reproductive rights. I assume Citizens United is fair game. But we're also going to spend a lot of time talking about her new book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy. The phone number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455. 1-800-222-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Professor Herman, I really enjoyed reading the book. I learned quite a bit. There's just real pearls in there about constitutional law, so I got a feeling you were taking some of the stuff from your classes and putting it into the book, which is professors are allowed to do that.
I think so. It's called multitasking.
That's right.
Recycling.
Let's just go through some of the key points of the book. First of all, why did you write this book? What was the point?
Well, you know, the opening anecdote that I tell is having sat next to a woman one night at dinner who said, "So tell me what the ACLU is doing these days, but don't tell me about that Guantanamo stuff," she said. "Why should I care about those people? They're not even Americans." So, you know, I personally have arguments for why I think she should care about anybody who's being treated unjustly. But it occurred to me that I think a lot of Americans really didn't know very much about how the war on terror was affecting ordinary Americans, which it is, and also how a lot of the things that people were concerned about during the Bush years, the Patriot Act, the government policies, surveillance, spying on Americans, gagging Americans, all sorts of things, those laws and practices, really, many of them have not changed under Barack Obama. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to say to the American people, I want to give them some information so that they can judge for themselves how we're doing with all these extraordinary measures that were put into place in the fall of 2001. Because it seems to me it's understandable if right after 9/11 we were a little panicky and we were just putting things like the Patriot Act into law without really knowing whether they were going to do any good. But 10 years later, when we now have enough information about the problems that have been created about a lot of these measures, and when we still have a lot of reason to doubt whether these measures are effective or indeed even counterproductive, what I really wanted to do was to inspire more of a national conversation, really to get Congress and the President to really start reexamining some of the things that we're now taking for granted as part of our law.
When I was reading your book, Professor Herman, I was struck with the continuity between the Bush and Obama administrations, which you make quite clear throughout is much greater than I think many people thought would be the case based on their observations or assessments of both Bush and Obama. And it made me think of a book that a friend of mine, John Nichols, who's a frequent guest in the show and my frequent co-author, wrote about 6 years ago called The Genius of Impeachment. When he basically looked at why the founders put impeachment in the Constitution, what the thinking was around it, he made the case that if you don't impeach a president when they break the law, then basically the next president, no matter what their politics, you've got the threat they're going to do it. And there's a strong gravitational pull for people in power to take advantage of whatever tools are at their disposal, not to give them up.
I think that's exactly right. You know, one metaphor that a couple of people have thought of, including me and John Stewart, is it's sort of like the Lord of the Rings. Once you have this very powerful tool, even though you know it's not really a wholesome tool and no good comes of using it, it's just extremely difficult to give up tools. Especially, I think that a new president coming in, it's not just that they want to take advantage, but I think what we hear from the Obama administration is that they believe that they can be trusted with the powerful ring, because they're going to use their discretion wisely. And I think that the lesson of the framers of the Constitution is that we don't trust anybody to use power wisely. We always have checks and balances and accountability, and that just hasn't been happening enough.
Let's talk a little bit, Professor Herman, about the Patriot Act. That term is used all the time, but I must confess I didn't really know what was in it. I just knew it was bad and that it let the government do all sorts of bad things, and I didn't like it. But so why don't you give a flavor of a couple of the components of the Patriot Act that have been most egregious in your view?
Sure. First, let me say that you're not the only one who doesn't know what's in the Patriot Act. Nobody knew what was in the Patriot Act, because what the Patriot Act was a collection of about 300 amendments to previous law. I mean, I'm using the number 300. It printed out about 300 pages, but it was hundreds of amendments in all different areas to previous law. It's not all bad. There's one part of it that's a sense of Congress resolution that people should not discriminate against Muslims, and that's great. But a lot of the Patriot Act was expanding the government's ability to spy on people, including Americans, without the usual kind of checks or process that we'd been accustomed to. So there are just a whole lot of provisions about surveillance. There's what came to be called the library provision, which allows the government to go into a secret court and with no showing to the judges to just say, we want an order to find out what books people have been taking out of a library or to look at people's school records or all sorts of information in the hands of third parties. And without explaining to a court what reason they have, they just get to certify and say, we think we're, you know, we're going to get something relevant, or we hope we are. And then the court must sign the order. So, you know, the librarians were up in arms about that. There's another provision expanding what were called national security letters, where the government can demand certain kinds of information from Internet service providers and librarians in some cases without going to a court at all. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act has been greatly expanded so that the government can use it much more often, can use its provisions to conduct surveillance on Americans. So that's one whole kind of thing that the Patriot Act did, just expanding the government's ability to get more surveillance with less accountability and less role of the courts, just all, you know, everything behind closed doors.
As I read the book, Professor Herman, I was struck by how unaccountable people in power are now for what they do to people, including American citizens, on one hand, and secondly, just how frequently they screw up, how the thing is complete fiasco. And you give story after story of the government screwing up and doing terrible things to citizens' lives, innocent citizens, and really the law protecting them, covering their butts. So they could, they're strong. I guess what I'm getting at is the way the system is structured. If you're in the government and you're in the business of hunting out terrorists and spying people, it's structured in such a way that you have very low cost for screwing up and overkilling. You can get away with all sorts of stuff, so there's just not that much discretion.
Well, I think you're right about the being very little cost, because one thing that we kind of bought into in the fall of 2001 was that not only do the government need to have all of these powers, expanded tools, the Patriot Act called it, to fight terrorism, like more surveillance, more having your bank telling the government what you're doing, you know, just all sorts of things, but that all of these powers also had to be exercised in secret, because if the enemy knew, you know, what we were doing for enforcement, therefore, you know, that might help them, and therefore we just had to trust the government. We had to trust the executive branch to just do the right thing, and they would say, well, no, why would we want to go after people who aren't terrorists? But I think what you're saying, Bob, is that secrecy is a great cover for any kind of mistake, and sometimes I think it's not that people are being, you know, vicious or venal or trying to purposely go after someone who's innocent. It's just often I think the government agents involved in many of the stories that I tell were trying too hard, and they saw things that just weren't there because they really wanted to find a sleeper cell, and what they found was innocent Americans or, you know, innocent, you know, visitors, and as you say, there was just no accountability, because when things are happening in secret, we often just didn't know what was being done with these powers.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Susan N. Herman, the professor of law at Brooklyn Law School, and also the president of the American Civil Liberties Union since 2008. She's the author of the new book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy. The phone number here at Media Matters is 217-333-9455, our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Herman, we got an email from someone whose phone was dying, so they couldn't call in, asking Tom from Paris, Illinois, asking how many Second Amendment cases has the ACLU represented? And before you answer that, maybe explain what the Second Amendment is.
Okay. The Second Amendment, I would dare say, is the worst written part of the Constitution. It's just, you know, completely impossible to read it and know what it says. It begins by saying that the right to bear arms, a well-regulated militia, I'm just trying to remember offhand the words, but it says something like a well-regulated militia being essential to the security of the state, the people's right to bear arms, people's right to bear arms shall not be, I forget what the verb is. And the mystery about this provision, ever since it was written, was whether it was designed to allow people to be part of a militia, or whether it was in fact intended to be an individual right to bear arms. The Supreme Court, quite recently, just a few years ago, and, you know, switching gears after, you know, a very long time of taking the opposite position, held that it is in fact an individual right to bear arms. Our policy on that had gone along with what the Supreme Court had always said, which was that it was not an individual right to bear arms, but that, in fact, the courts had said that it was really a collective right, and it was really about the people's right to participate in militias as a counter to the federal standing armies. And therefore, we had not done any Second Amendment work because there wasn't any Second Amendment in the courts, and that was just the court's interpretation. Since the court decided the case in Heller versus United States, we've had our...
Now, what year was that, if I may ask?
I hate to say off the top of my head. It was maybe, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, it's that recently?
Oh, it's quite recent.
I thought, frankly, from the coverage and discourse, that the Second Amendment was always understood as an individual's right to have whatever weapons they wanted.
Well, there were always people who argued that. But it's been really a very heavily argued question in among academics as well as among the American people, what the Second Amendment did mean. And the most recent, I believe it was 1939 or 37, there was a case called Miller versus United States, where the Supreme Court said pretty clearly that they believed it was a collective right and not an individual right. And so the ACLU policy in that area said, well, the Supreme Court says this is a collective right. And so, how are you going to go to court and say, we have an individual right when the Supreme Court says you don't? So it really, the Heller is within the past decade. I'm sorry, just off the top of my head.
Okay, that's fair enough.
I hadn't expected to answer questions.
Oh, 2008, I'm looking it up right here.
2008, okay, so yeah, that's what I thought about 4 or 5 years ago. So since then, we have actually had a board committee working on what our position should be. And this is very complicated because we have 50 affiliates all around the country. We have 83 people on our board, and our processes just take a very long time. I just actually heard about one of our affiliates just did a case where they were relying on the Second Amendment. And again, not having expected to talk about this, I can't come up with the facts off the top of my head. But this is an area in which I would just have to say to people, stay tuned. We're thinking about it.
The ACLU's position is information. So
information, right, in response to the Heller case.
The various chapters each have a chance to have a weigh-in on it and participate in the...
That's right. Yeah, each affiliate has a representative to the national board.
Now, I know the Citizens United decision is probably the most well-known and controversial, even, frankly, among my listening audience, detested Supreme Court decision in memory. And what's the ACLU's position on Citizens United, and how did it reach that? What was the nature of the debate internally?
Okay, we have had, what I want to tell you is that one of the articles of faith of civil libertarians is that there are issues on which reasonable people can differ. One of my colleagues once said, and I thought this was a great line, they said, if you agree with the ACLU 80% of the time, you should be a member. And if you agree with the ACLU 50% of the time, you should be on the board. And I can tell you, we have looked at the issue of campaign finance, I think it was something like 17 times over the last 30, 40 years. The board keeps looking at it, and the board keeps being divided just about down the middle in terms of the concept of the First Amendment that we should, in fact, be applying to campaign finance. So our policy had been, until a few years ago, that the First Amendment prohibited regulation of expenditures as well as contributions to campaigns. We recently amended that policy to decide that, in fact, there is a compelling interest to allow the government to regulate contributions to campaigns, and that is appropriate. But where we draw the line is to not allow the government to be regulating expenditures, if people are spending money to publish things. And that's because we just think, the classic First Amendment idea is the more speech, the better. In these days of the Internet, I think, you want everybody to be able to say everything possible. Now, in the Citizens United case, I think there is a rumor going around, which is really not true, that we argued that corporations have the same rights as everybody else, and that we argued for the position that the Supreme Court actually took, which was to overrule previous case law. That was not what our brief said. We wrote an amicus brief that only objected to the breadth and the vagueness of the particular campaign finance regulation in question. And the reason why we objected to the vagueness of that is that, in fact, the ACLU itself is a corporation. And under that law, we would not have been allowed to take out an ad that said, tell President Obama if he's elected he should close Guantanamo. We just wouldn't have been allowed to take positions. And so that was the reason for our concern. There, too, since Citizens United, we, again, have a committee working on the question of whether, in fact, there is a reason to treat corporations any differently from individuals. But our policy right now is that individuals or corporations can, in fact, be prohibited from campaign contributions because it's not right that people should own candidates. But we just don't see any way to start telling people what they can say and what they can't say, because at that point, I think there's so much it's sort of like, you know, trying to squeeze the toothpaste around in a closed tube. You know, the money will go someplace else, and if you prohibit it from being spent in one place, it will be spent in another. One more thing I'll mention is that I think people often associate Citizens Union with corporate spending. But in fact, you know, most of the biggest donors to political, the PACs and to election campaigns, as well as the expenditures these days, are individuals. They're not corporations. So that should give you some sense of, I think that our board has really been divided for years on this issue, again, right just down the middle. And if you heard the discussions we had, they're extremely sophisticated First Amendment discussions about what the First Amendment means and how best to implement it. So I think the whole issue that was raised by Citizens United is not nearly as simple as a lot of people seem to want to think.
You know, I was struck by reading an article not too long ago where, and I don't want to get into the legal weeds on this, because I want to keep it sort of at an understandable level, but Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, who I think were in the minority on Citizens United on the Supreme
right.
Court, noted that, you know, one of the major claims for it was that this unlimited check on giving would not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. They said, well, that's clearly already, we're barely out of the gate in 2012, and it's now transparent that that's false, or it looks false. We need to revisit it because that basic claim for this decision no longer holds up. Was that a basic claim of the decision, of the majority opinion?
Well, I think part of the whole question here is, again, the vagueness question, because once you take the position that it's all right to limit people's expenditures, then you have to say whose expenditures you're limiting, when you're having the limitations, what the limitations are. And I think that the whole question of what leads to an appearance of corruption, it's a very vague standard.
Okay, well, I'll let callers follow up on this if they want with you. Our guest today, Susan Herman, president of the ACLU, author of Taking Liberties. Phone number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The toll-free line is open. You know, one of the issues you deal with throughout your book, Taking Liberties, Professor Herman, is the argument, you've already mentioned it, which is, you know, this doesn't affect me. If I'm not a terrorist, I really have nothing to worry about. So I'm just going to shut up and go with the flow and assume people in power, you know, take care of things okay, and I have nothing to worry about. And I gather from the way you mentioned it in the book several times, and you've already mentioned it here, this is a common response that you get dealing with people. And, you know, what do you say when you're in the elevators? You've only got 45 seconds. So what do you tell people to say that is really not very smart?
Well, I think the 45-second version is probably a story. Like Nick George, who was a 22-year-old college student who was flying from his home in Philadelphia to Pomona, and he had been studying Middle Eastern studies because he had become very interested in what was happening in the world. And he took his Arabic-English flashcards to study on the plane. And that led to an agent who found the flashcards in his hand luggage, pulling him aside, interrogating him for 5 hours, detaining him in a separate room, and he missed his flight because the agent assumed that anybody who was studying Arabic must be connected with terrorism. He said to Nick, who was 22, do you know who did 9/11, and do you know what language he spoke? Yeah, now do you see why this is suspicious? So, you know, that's an example of, you said, too much discretion is going to lead to mistakes.
And, you know, that points to also, which is something that alone would be a cause, should be a cause of just massive outrage, which your book makes clear, and I think that example you just gave makes clear, that it's more or less open season on Muslim Americans, on Arab Americans, and just on people anywhere from the range of the world, from the Indonesia to Morocco, are fair game in this country.
But, and that turns out to be true, and that also applies to American citizens.
Exactly.
Another story I tell of Eric Sherfin, who was a veteran of the Gulf War, while he was over in the Gulf, he was given sensitivity training, which included some information about Islam. And when he got back, he was very interested in religion and decided to convert. Now, what he was doing, he had been a helicopter pilot during the war, and after his honorable discharge, he took a job as a commercial pilot. And one day, his employer calls him in and says, we're going to have to fire you unless you can get off the no-fly list. And it turns out Eric couldn't imagine why he was on the no-fly list, other than he was a Muslim. And it turned out that that seems to have had a lot to do with it, because this wasn't even the government agents who had made the mistake, but one of Eric's coworkers, who knew that he was a Muslim and therefore was very suspicious of him just for that reason, reported to the FBI that Eric had retrofitted his car to carry bombs. And what that was based on was that Eric had a broken seat in his car and had taken the car seat out, which is what his colleague had seen. So, you know, when all these decisions are being made behind closed doors with no accountability, of course there are going to be mistakes because people are going to report things like that. The other thing I think that people should know is that the surveillance affects all sorts of people as to whom there is no basis for suspicion that they themselves are terrorists. Some of the grounds for surveillance allow the government to collect information that they think might lead to something that might get them someplace on terrorism. So I mentioned these national security letters that could be used mm-hmm. with internet service providers and librarians. These have been used hundreds of thousands of times, hundreds of thousands. And we have had at this point only six of the people who were asked for this information, five librarians and one internet service provider, have tried to challenge this, have tried to protest, which means that on hundreds of thousands of occasions, the people who have our confidential information just turned it over to the government. And so, you know, we don't even know, what's happening behind closed doors. I tell the stories of some people who suddenly were very surprised to find out that they were on a no-fly list, American Express would cancel their card, their bank would tell them that they could no longer have an account at their bank. A lot of those people are Muslims, not all of them.
Our guest, Susan Herman, from the president of the ACLU, author of the new book, Taking Liberties. Let's go to our phone lines now. Let's go to line two, Champaign County. You're on the air with Susan Herman.
Oh.
Yes, line two, are you there?
Right, I thought somebody was ahead of me, and speaker, I'm taking it off right now.
Okay, thank you.
Vis-a-vis the Obama administration, I'm sure the ACLU doesn't have a track record dealing with the Espionage Act because it hasn't been used in so many years, but it's used, been used like six or seven times against mainly whistleblowers as opposed to, it's a judgment call. And I don't know if the Civil Liberties Union is weighing in on that. I think it's an important issue, though. But the other thing I wanted to ask about is this House Bill 304, the National Security Bubble Act, as it might be called. And I guess that language goes back to Clinton declaring areas National Security Act. This makes it an immediate felony, I guess, or potential of charging people with an immediate felony if they're anywhere near anybody protected by a Secret Service agent. I think that's my understanding of it. And there's been accusation that the usual rights groups have been not too active on campaigning against this, that the ACLU opposed this when it was offered in both the House and the Senate last year, and I'd just like to hear you on that, if I could.
Well, thank you very much, caller. So I guess there's two parts, H.R. 304 and the Espionage Act. You want to field those, Susan Herman?
Well, sure. Again, just off the top of me, we have, as I said, we have 50 affiliates. We have a Washington legislative office that has dozens of people working for it. And I'm sorry not to be able to tell you specifically what the Washington legislative office has or hasn't done on those particular bills. But I can tell you in general that we have been quite active for ever since the early Bush administration years trying to defend the First Amendment against the whole bubble idea. There were any number of cases, including litigation cases that we brought on behalf of people who were not allowed to get near to places where President Bush was speaking. We represented one couple who were kicked out of a speech that they were attending because they were wearing T-shirts that had messages that were unfavorable to President Bush. And, of course, we're nonpartisan, so, whoever it is who people are protesting or whoever is being protected by the Secret Service, we think that people should have adequate First Amendment rights. Yeah, I can't tell you the details of what our office did on that particular act, but if you go to our website, aclu.org, there's an enormous amount of information about the things we are doing. The initial questioners, questions were sort of focusing on the things that we don't do, the Second Amendment, what we're not doing in that area, but we do like hundreds of things in all sorts of other areas. And I think you could find out more specifically what's there. I also was down recently at our Washington office, and I met some of the whistleblowers, Thomas Drake and some of the other whistleblowers who had been active about what the NSA was doing, the National Security Agency, and they are people who the ACLU has been very much involved with. So those issues are very much on our screen And again, I apologize that I can't have 100% command of everything to be able to tell you exactly, you know, what lobbying was done on those particular bills.
Well, you mentioned something, Susan Herman, that I'd like to ask you a little bit more about, which is, you know, we've seen an upsurge in popular protests in the United States in the last year or so across the country, typified by the Occupy movement, but by no means exclusively the Occupy movement. And this touches on, you know, two of the five components of the First Amendment, the right to assemble and the right to redress grievances to the government. And, you know, one of the things that is striking is the effort of governments to make it much more difficult for people to assemble and redress grievances. You know, what is the ACLU? Do you know what you're doing there, or can you talk about that? And is how serious of an issue is this?
Well, I think it's a very serious issue. I mean, what we were just talking about, you know, the bubble idea. Plus, President Obama just signed another bill that affects the right of photographers to photograph, you know, federal buildings and so forth. As to the Occupy movement, because we have affiliates all over the country, I can't even tell you how many of our affiliates were heavily engaged in working with the people from the Occupy movements to try to ensure that their rights were properly respected, you know, their right to assemble, their right to demonstrate. And I think it was the ACLU offices, because of our long expertise in the First Amendment, that were frequently called upon by people who were protesting as well to find out not only what their rights were, but what the appropriate limits were. Because there are places where the Supreme Court has said, for example, that it is not a violation of the First Amendment to prohibit people from camping out on public property overnight. So, you know, you don't have a First Amendment right to do that. So we can't really go into court and represent that people do. But we could, in fact, in a lot of places, lobby and try to work with your city administrators to try to make sure that people would have an adequate opportunity to demonstrate. And because we have affiliates in all the different states, we were also able to make arguments where the First Amendment was not really available because the Supreme Court has interpreted it narrowly. We were able to make arguments based on state constitutional law or state laws to try to get people their right to demonstrate. So that's an issue that's very much on our screen.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. Before we get there, let me remind people that the lines are open here at WILL, the number 217-333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We've got another call from Paris, Illinois. It seems to be a hot spot for us today. Line one, Paris, you're on the air with Susan Herman.
Yeah, hi, Susan.
Hi.
My question is, if you had a terrorist incident in this country, a major one every week or once a month, like a car bombing or anything, where would our civil liberties be then? I mean, I would assume that it would really tighten up quite a bit, and if they couldn't stop it, where would it end up?
Well, I think it's a great question, because I think the reason why we've had all the challenges to our civil liberties in the past decade, of course, were because of 9/11, and that really changed a lot of our approach to the laws. I think that, you know, people do react to incidents by wanting every time to try to allow the government more power, more leeway to act. And I think the thrust of your question, which is that civil liberties would suffer if there were a terrorist incident every week, is right. But that doesn't mean that we're, in fact, doing things that are effective. And so I think we nevertheless have to do what we're doing instead of just trying to throw away more civil liberties every time something else happens. And one thing that I talk about in my book, which, you know, as Bob says, comes from my constitutional law professor hat, is the fact that the framers of the Constitution were extremely familiar with threats to safety and national security happening on our shores. They survived the War of 1812. There were British sleeper cells all over, you know, when the colonies were new. And when you look at what the framers have to say about national security and the fact that they drafted the Constitution that they drafted, including the Bill of Rights, nevertheless, I think that it is our responsibility to make sure that we're not just, you know, the whole idea that you have to give up your civil liberties to be safe, well, that doesn't mean that you will be safe if you give up your civil liberties or someone else's civil liberties. I think you really have to ask questions about whether we're doing the right things or the smart things.
You know, as I read your book and in my own experiences, and probably I'm going to get on some list for even asking this question, which is, confirms the thesis of your book, but, you know, you see these airport, what do they call, porno scanners now, where you have to go be shot, and if you have an X-ray taken of you as you try to board a plane, and if you dare protest, you're sure going to get worked over. And You see all these mechanisms you describe in the book, which is unclear if they work. It seems like they're fighting the last war, not the next war. And if someone was a serious terrorist, they'd come up with a way to easily bypass that if that was their goal. They just wouldn't walk in through the airport scanner loading with a gun. And, you know, you at some point you sort of wonder maybe these, you know, these sort of extreme libertarians have something that this is about just sort of intimidating people and just sort of getting us to be docile and go along with these intrusions in our freedoms that people never would have put up with in the past.
Well, I think that's true, too. One person, Bruce Schneier, who writes a lot of books about this, coined a great phrase, which is security theater. And I think that the most obvious explanation in some ways for a lot of what you see at the airports and a lot of what you see, you know, happening with our tax dollars is that the government is trying to make us feel safe. And they're doing things that people want to assume, in fact, are leading to our safety because we're sure. I recently read that we are spending more money on national security than all the rest of the countries in the world combined. Now, again, does that keep us safe? It doesn't keep us safe if we're not doing the right things and if we're spending, you know, I don't know how many millions of dollars on all the airport machinery that we're using. Yeah, I think there are better ways that a lot of people have thought of really addressing the problem without just, again, you know, sort of tossing away the civil liberties.
Let's go back to our phone lines right now. Our guest, Susan Herman, president of the ACLU, author of the new book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy. Now let's go to line four, Peoria. You're on the air.
Hi. This is different than the terrorism issue, but and I don't know if ACLU has a position on the some school districts in Illinois around here requiring or want to require students who are in extracurricular activities to take drug tests. And also, I think in Kentucky they had proposed that people on welfare were required to take drug tests. And I didn't know what the ACLU, if they had a position or what their position is. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, thanks for that question. In fact, we have long opposed the random drug testing of students or, you know, the routine drug testing of students or welfare recipients. And we litigated a case in the Supreme Court. Again, off the top of my head, I can't tell you exactly what year it was decided. But the young woman who's the plaintiff in that case, Lindsay Earls, was going to high school in Oklahoma, Pottawatomie County, Oklahoma, and she is now actually a member of the ACLU National Board because she was so upset about the violation of her privacy and Fourth Amendment rights that she litigated when her high school, the school district, started a drug testing for all students in extracurricular activities. And Lindsay was in the choir. And the school was talking about, well, you know, you had to drug test all the kids because what if the kids in the choir were high and they fell off the choral risers? And, you know, Lindsay thought this was pretty far-fetched, and she just was very offended by, you know, having to take this drug test. We litigated that case, and we actually lost that in the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court allows drug testing of students for extracurricular activities. But again, a number of our affiliates can continue to fight measures like that in the states on the basis of state law. And we do oppose drug testing of welfare recipients.
Susan,
we think that, you know, if you're going to have something that intrusive, there should be some individualized suspicion, some reason to test people.
Susan Herman, we had on this program roughly, I'm guessing, less than a year ago, a former ACLU attorney, Michelle Alexander, who now professes law at The Ohio State University, and she wrote a book called The New Jim Crow. I suspect you're familiar with it.
It's a really, terrific book.
It is a terrific book. And I think it makes an extraordinarily powerful case that the entire drug war and the prison industrial complex is very much stacked against African Americans. Frankly, when I finished the book, I said, if anyone reads this book, you're going to be against the drug war immediately. You can't defend it after reading that book. And I was wondering, is this an issue that's resonating at the ACLU at all? Is this on your in your view over there? Is that considered a different type of issue?
Well, here's where we are connecting with this, and we were delighted when Michelle's book came out. She did, you know, early in her career, work for the ACLU of Northern California for the Racial Justice Project. And we had already decided to target over-incarceration as one of our, you know, foremost initiatives in this country, and largely because of the fact that the criminal justice system has such a disproportionate effect on people of color, especially, you know, African-American men. So the whole idea is not even just the war on drugs. We go a little bit broader than that. If you look at the statistics, it's really just shocking. First, our addiction to over-incarceration. We, in this country, we lock up more people than any other country in the world, both in terms of percentage of population and in terms of actual numbers. So even a much more populous country like China does not incarcerate as many people as we do. And when you look at the statistics about the disproportion of the number of minority people who are arrested, prosecuted, incarcerated, held for a long time, it's really pretty shocking. And it's not even just the individual who's incarcerated who suffers from these really discriminatory policies, but it's their families. Families are tremendously disrupted when somebody is a parent is arrested and is not there to be with children. So the whole idea of attacking incarceration, again, if people are interested in what we're doing, in a number of different states, we've been working on alternatives to incarceration. And you can look at our website to see the kinds of things that we're doing. But in addition, the other thing that we're working on is what our we have a racial justice project, which is working on what they call the school-to-prison pipeline issues. And there what we're working on is the fact that statistics show a tremendous disparity in terms of how children are disciplined in schools. So if two children do a similar naughty thing, like throw an eraser at a teacher, the white child will be told, please don't do that again, and the black child will be suspended. And what statistics also show is that the best predictor of somebody ending up in the criminal justice system in prison, whether for a drug arrest or whatever else, is having had their education disrupted, having been suspended from school. So that is a tremendously important issue to us, over-incarceration and also the unequal impact of the criminal justice system on minorities.
Another issue that's really come to the fore in the past 18 months, since the 2010 elections, has been a number of states in the United States have all enacted and proposed very similar legislation. It seems like it was written almost by the same person to restrict voting rights or to make it much more difficult for people to vote and put requirements on for people to vote. And it's hard to look at this and not see a partisan tinge because the motor force behind it is the Republicans almost exclusively. And the voters who are going to be left out of the polls are voting groups that vote overwhelmingly Democratic or non-Republican. Wisconsin, any state that has a sort of a trifecta of a Republican governor and state legislature in both houses is passing these sort of bills, Wisconsin being one in the Midwest. What's your take on this phenomenon, and does the ACLU have a dog in this race?
Well, we have an extremely large dog. Where we don't have a dog is we are nonpartisan, and therefore it doesn't make any difference to us whether Republicans are preventing Democrats from voting or vice versa.
No, and I didn't mean to suggest it was, but I was just giving the actual facts of the situation.
Yeah, I understand that, but I just wanted to confirm that we don't do things just because they help or hinder one party or the other, but we are very much concerned that everybody have a right to vote because that is the most fundamental right in the Constitution. So in addition to what you were saying, Bob, about just general measures that suppress the vote, the kinds of restrictions that are being adopted in any number of states, not Illinois, but as you say, Wisconsin and the battleground states like Florida and Ohio, are laws that tend to particularly disproportionately affect minorities, the elderly, the disabled, the poor.
Students.
So let me give you an example of the woman who is the lead plaintiff in a case that the ACLU is bringing in Wisconsin to challenge, as you were saying, the Wisconsin voter ID law. Ruth L. Frank is 84 years old. She has voted in every election since 1948. But under the new voter ID law, she has to have a document like a birth certificate in order to be allowed to vote. She doesn't have a birth certificate because she was born at home. And the only other way that she can get the kind of identification that she would need to be allowed to vote in the next election is there's one government record that she would have to obtain. However, her maiden name was misspelled on that record. So she would have to spend hundreds of dollars to have that record corrected through litigation in order to be able to vote. So that's one example. Let me give you, two other examples from Ohio and Florida. Both of those states are now restricting early voting. They're restricting absentee voting and same-day registration. Florida has restricted third-party registration to the point where the League of Women Voters had to stop registering people in Florida.
Now, does this have anything to do with voter fraud? This just seems like trying to repress the turnout.
Well, that's the claim. The claim is that all this is being done for voter fraud. However, the voter fraud is just minuscule. the Department of Justice released a study of a whole long period of votes, and I, again, off the top of my head, I can't give you the figures. They're on our website. But out of hundreds of thousands of votes, there were like 86 examples of fraud. Most of the examples of fraud, of voter fraud, come in for voters that are not covered by the voter ID laws. They come from absentee ballots. And most of the things that look like fraud, in fact, are just good faith mistakes of people who didn't really understand why they were voting. So certainly this is a very small fly, if you know, it's a problem at all. So I think that the courts should be more receptive to claims that, in fact, these are pretty cynical laws that are, in fact, just disenfranchising people. And we are working very hard to fight these laws.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. Our guest today is Susan Herman, the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, the author of the new book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy, just published by Oxford University Press. Another issue, while we're on the topic of breaking issues that's gotten a lot of attention in the last year, has been the attack on contraception, on reproductive rights.
Right.
And and what is the ACLU? Are you is the group involved in that? And if so, what do you see going on, and what would you like to see happen?
Well, that's another area where I think that really sort of fits our basic theme of defending targets of intolerance. And it's pretty shocking that these days the intolerance of women and their right to reproductive freedom is not only about abortion but even about contraception. So, you know, there are states, in Mississippi, for example, we did beat back a challenge that would have banned abortion pretty much altogether, lobbying and working against that. In Illinois, you may know, the ACLU of Illinois has been very active for a number of years trying to defend the reproductive freedom of women in Illinois. And I'm sure you're aware that the House Agriculture Committee has this pending bill. I think it's still pending. To require women to get an ultrasound before they could have an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, just recently came up in Virginia.
And it seems to be everywhere. It's sort of like the voting rights bill. It's like kudzu.
Exactly.
These things pop up everywhere.
Exactly. It's just these things are just going viral. So there are states all around the country. So at the same time that our affiliates are extremely busy working on voter suppression measures and anti-immigrant measures, there are also reproductive freedom measures. These ultrasound bills are popping up all over the place. And just anything that will prevent women from making the choice, their choices about their own reproductive freedom.
Our guest, Susan Herman. There's still time if someone wants to call in at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You know, the something that you mentioned briefly in the book, Susan Herman, that I thought was really interesting was WikiLeaks, which is, the sort of a dominant free speech or free press issue, but it gets very much into the sinews of the relationship of the government to censorship of speech and national security. Is the ACLU working on the WikiLeaks case in any capacity?
I think not directly. We had, in fact, I think what we were working on for a while was while Private Manning was being held in custody in what were pretty deplorable conditions. I think that we did have lawyers who were working on that issue.
What is the state of Private Manning now?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I really do. I haven't been following.
Okay, I thought he still was in deplorable conditions. That's why.
So far, unfortunately, I don't have enough brain cells or hours in the day to follow
that's
in detail
enough.
Everything we're doing. So I assure you that we have people on our staff who would have very good answers to that question. what I am as president of the board, I'm chairman of the board in effect.
No,
so
I understand.
I have my day job of teaching.
No, I understand. You're not the executive director. You're not managing operations on a daily basis.
And I'm not the lawyer actually working on some of these cases.
Well, let me give you a question that relates to your book then. As I read your book, the one question I had is how does this current attack on civil liberties and the war on terror, where does it rank, say, compared to the 1950s with the McCarthy period and the blacklist or the Palmer raids and the era that gave birth to the ACLU right after the First World War, right as it was ending? Or the COINTELPRO program against activists, civil rights, and anti-war groups in the 1960s and early 70s. I mean, do you think we're at a moment that's worse than that, equal to that? I mean, how would you characterize it people can sink their teeth into this gravity of the situation?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, one thing that what you're bringing up, all the periods of time you're bringing up, are again an example of Roger Bolden's thesis that no battle for civil liberties ever stays won. So there's an emergency. The American people overreact by sort of dropping our concerns about due process and freedom of speech, and then the emergency ends, and sometimes we go back. There's another really interesting book by Jeffrey Stone called Perilous Times, in which he talks about that phenomenon, and he says, well, at least we get better. This time we didn't lock up all the Muslims as we did, you know, intern Japanese Americans during World War II.
That would have been like 5 million people. What difference?
Exactly. It would be a big problem. But I think that the problem with this, in some ways, this is not like a wartime restriction, because the whole idea of a war on terror, you know, the metaphor is a little misleading, because a war ends and the emergency ends and you sign the treaty and then you go back to normal. And I think my great concern, there are many things that we're doing that are quite comparable to the McCarthy era and COINTELPRO and the Palmer raids, as you're saying. But my concern is that there's no end point in sight here. You know, when does this all end? And that's why, you know, writing this book, I was thinking after a decade, it really is about time that we sort of sat down calmly to look at whether all the measures that we just, you know, put into effect before anyone had had time to really diagnose the problem or really study what would be an effective countermeasure. After 10 years, I think we should be looking, because there's going to be no natural point. And at some point, what were put into law as emergency measures really do become the new normal.
Let's go back to the phone lines if we can. We have one final caller waiting patiently. Line 4, Urbana, you're on the air with Susan Herman of the ACLU.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask a question. Earlier, you were discussing the over-incarceration problem and racial minorities being incarcerated at much higher rates than we would otherwise expect. I've been touting that particular statistic for a long time, and I've encountered a lot of skepticism. And so I'm just wondering how you would respond to critics who would argue that, you know, it's the fact that we see more racial minorities being incarcerated than non-minorities is more an artifact of either them committing more crimes versus non-minorities, not pursuing all legal avenues. How would you respond to the argument that basically it's not a problem we need to worry about, that it's just a thing that's naturally occurring that we really can't correct?
Thank you very much, caller. We've got a couple minutes here for you, Susan Herman.
Okay, great question. Let me give you two answers. First, there is no way that the racial disproportion is naturally occurring. I think people who want to argue that there are different crime statistics for people who are African-American as opposed to other races, in some areas that may be true because of the fact that African-Americans all the way down the line, I was talking about the school-to-prison pipeline, are living in poorer, crime-ridden neighborhoods or going to schools that are worse, just on the average, of course, not everybody. So, you know, there are different things going on. And so, you know, to the extent that there might be different crime rates, I think that they are not naturally occurring. They're traceable to other things that are happening in our society that should be curable. Now, the more important answer in some ways to the direct question is there are a lot of places. Look in Michelle Alexander's book. Look on our website for our fact sheets about over-incarceration. There are many areas where, in fact, you can look at the statistics and where studies show that black people and white people commit crimes at about the same rates. There have been studies showing that about drug offenses. And in fact, what happens is that even though the level of committing the same offense, like the drug offense, is proportionate to someone's race, the enforcement is not. And that is not something that's occurring naturally. If more minority people are being arrested for drug offenses, that has something to do with how we're policing. I'm sure you're aware of the issue under federal law of the disparity of sentencing between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. That, again, is something that had racial consequences. The disproportion does not occur naturally. It's built into our law and our enforcement of the law, and sometimes to things that happened before the criminal law, like how students were treated in school.
You know, I hear the band tuning up in the background, Susan Herman, which means they want to kick me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for taking an hour out of your Sunday, out of your free day, I trust, to join us here at Media Matters.
Well, it's my pleasure, Bob. Thanks for having me. And our motto in the ACLU is, it's because freedom doesn't defend itself.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Our guest, Susan Herman, author of the new book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Liberty, published by Oxford, also the president of the ACLU. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board as usual, Christina Williams for being my producer. We'll be back 1 week from today, 167 hours, with Joe Turo talking about his new book on advertising the Internet. You're going to really be blown away by the show. I've just finished the book. I'm Bob McChesney. Everyone, have a great week. See you next week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners, or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Increasing clouds this afternoon with a high of 62 degrees. For tonight, showers and isolated thunderstorms, the low 52, wind gusts up to 25 miles an hour. Mostly cloudy skies tomorrow with a slight chance of morning rain. Afternoon showers possible as well. The high 70 degrees, winds up to 35 miles an hour. Mostly clear tomorrow night, the low 48. Sunny skies Tuesday, the high 72. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.